President Kleissman.
Thank you. Let me say, dear class, a certain apology I have to offer, namely, my physical condition has got somewhat worse through the day. I'm taking antibiotics, or otherwise I wouldn't even be here. But anyway, I won't go into a lot of details. So I have 2 hours to drive home, so I'll have to miss the faculty meeting. I just want to teach 1 hour today. That'll be the best I can do to try to get home, and then I'll just go to bed. And I don't know whether I'll be able to preach on Sunday or not, but the Lord will lead in that matter. But before I'm sorry to just be doing 1 hour, but hopefully, all being well, everything will be all right next week. Do I have any questions on anything? There we start.
Our paper next week, that's due. You want a physical copy of it?
Okay. For a physical copy, yeah. Okay. I know that we were discussing last time Tertullian, and I believe we got into his views of forgiveness a little bit, positive and negative. Is that right? You remember that? Positive, he helps see it in terms of debt. Guilt is debt, and the repayment of debt. And that's been very important in the Western Catholic and Protestant understanding of how you get forgiven. It has its positives, it has its negatives. But on the less helpful side, we looked at the idea, particularly in his book, De Baptismo, on baptism. You know, put it off as long as you can, because you may do some serious sins towards the end, so just wait. And that's that was hurtful in the Western Church. And yet I'll have to say that, to his credit, or Tertullian's credit, he was not an easy believer. You know, I don't think we have to be either a legalist. I certainly don't want to be a legalist ever. But I don't think we have to be an antinomian, an easy believer. And certainly anybody that seriously studies the theology of the church at this time will know they were not, quote, easy believers. That's Tertullian, and I could say much more. Let's put capital D, Hippolytus of Rome, Hippolytus. Hippolytus of Rome. He was a remarkable scholar, as I said, of the Roman Church. He's probably born in the East, maybe Alexandria, we're not sure, about the year 170. So we're talking early times. And he moved to Rome, was called there to minister, and became one of the big leaders. When the famous church writer, you can't call him a church father because he had too many heretical ideas, but I think it's probably a Christian, Origen, O-R-I-G-E-N, was visiting Rome in the year 212. He wanted to go hear the most famous people, and one of the most famous people he could go hear was Hippolytus in one of the churches. And he said, Hippolytus preached this tremendous sermon on, quote, on the praises of our Lord and Savior. I'd love to have heard it. Hippolytus was a priest, as I say, a presbyter priest. And then later he became kind of what some call an anti-pope. He set up a group to oppose the pope, whom he didn't like. Pope didn't have the full thing that later medieval popes had, but Bishop of Rome had a lot of civil importance. And anyway, he kind of split with the current pope, but then later he got reconciled to the church. And along with the guy that was Pope Pontianus, they were both sent off to Sardinia to a forced labor camp. and were both martyred there about the year 235. Hippolytus' body was brought back to Rome and buried in the cemetery of Via Tiburtina. Have you ever been there, Gene? I don't remember if I have or not. Via Tiburtina. I don't remember. I mean, it's not Via Solaris, or which I wouldn't know. I honestly don't know exactly where Via Tiburtina is, but it's well known. And the story goes on. They brought him back, I don't know what, 235 or something. Move on 1,300 years. And in the year 1551, when work was being done near the ancient church of St. Lawrence, San Lorenzo, a statue was discovered of Hippolytus. Only 1,300 years old, sitting on a chair covered with the pallium of a teacher. Essentially, it's people that know they're being said, it's 3rd century art without any doubt. On this chair is a complete list of all the works of Hippolytus, as well as the paschal table he compiled for the determining of the date to celebrate Easter year by year. So we've got a lot of things. We've lost most of it. Some has been discovered from time to time, and I would predict more will be discovered, as I believe more will be discovered of St. Irenaeus, particularly as we can get into Armenia and some other places. But anyway, another story. One of his most important works was, well, I'll give it to you in English first, Refutation of All Heresies, Refutation of All Heresies, or Philosophumena, Refutation of All Heresies. And it was rediscovered in 1842. And it was listed on that table that's on the chair where he was, funereal chair. It contained 10 books, Philosophumena, or Refutation of All Heresies. Books 2 and 3 are still lost. So, in other words, they've got 8 out of the 10. That's pretty good. In Book 1, the introduction, Hippolytus wants to show that heresy is only superficially Christian. I mean, let me not harp on one string, and I have tendency to do this. But I really think theistic evolution is only superficially Christian. I think individuals who believe in theistic evolution are Christians. That I believe. Or at least many of them. But the philosophy is only superficially Christian. They get their bearings from the secularistic culture. Another story. Well, that's what he felt about the heresy that was really, I won't say flooding, but moving pretty rapidly into the Christian churches. He said the different heresies are republications of pagan humanism in religious clothing. It's interesting. I mean, let's say when the mainline Protestant churches in the United States of America went liberal, which was the first 30, 40 years of the 20th century, and they couldn't have gone liberal if the modernist masters had not clothed secular humanism in religious clothing. They had to use religious clothing or they wouldn't have got anywhere. And he said that's what they have done. All right, there are two basic parts of Philosophumena. Books 1 to 4. Exposes the various pagan man-centered systems. Lays out what they taught. Book 1 particularly deals with the history of Greek philosophy, which is interesting to me because I read a lot of that when I was at Carolina. And also, interestingly, he deals with some strands of Eastern Hindu thoughts. I mean, you know, Rome, say, how had he known about Hindu? Well, Rome was a melting pot for the whole world, an international trade center, and had marvelous libraries. So they knew about the different religions. In many ways, the culture that Hippolytus was dealing with is not unlike European culture or American culture in the urban settings, London or what have you. And so he knew, he was able to go to the library and read what many strands of Hindu thought, and probably met people, talked to them. Books 2 and 3 were on the mystery religions, which is very interesting because they kept their stuff secret. They wouldn't tell you. I'm told, and some of you let me know if I'm getting this wrong, that the Mormons, in fact, we had one year in First Presbyterian Jackson, three Mormon families that got converted and joined the church. Wonderful people. And I gathered from them, they didn't want to be overly critical, but I mean, they were glad to be in evangelical religion, that to get you in, the Mormons don't tell you some of the secret esoteric doctrines, like you can become a god and populate your own universe, and Jesus is still having children, and terrible things. That's hidden. But they tell you family, self-reliance, tithing, hard work, and so on. And so Hippolytus shows that there were elements of that in the Greek mystery religions, that they hid a lot of the material till you got in it. So therefore, he can tell us some, but not everything, because he wasn't a member. And books 2 and 3, where he really discusses it, are lost. We pick up things he said about him in other books, but the thing totally dedicated to the mystery religions, books 2 and 3 are long gone. Maybe they'll turn up. Book 4 dealt with astrology and magic. That's interesting. Nothing new. They tell me, I mean, that this is true 20 years ago, it may not be true now, that if any of the major newspapers take out the astrology section, they get so many protests in one day they have to put it back. That a lot of people go by astrology to plan their day and their week. It's hard to believe, isn't it? I mean, those people probably sit in a Christian church or a formerly Christian church, but you wonder, I mean, maybe they got an excellent pastor. Could be. But it may be he doesn't preach to the real world, and so they don't know. But he talks about, this is interesting, some of the surprisingly modern tricks they had to emulate something that was magic. I mean, they could move tin and make you think it's thunder, and that's coming from the gods, or all kind of things they could do. He felt astrology and magic is fake. That's what he thought. By the way, please don't let somebody tell you that the early Christian church believed everything, believed anything, was credulous. No, they weren't. You read Hippolytus. They weren't credulous. Books 5 to 9 expose 33 Gnostic sects and connects them with their parent pagan humanism. Interestingly, Tertullian thought that, Irenaeus thought that, Hippolytus thought that. So why wouldn't they have been right? They were closer to it than ourselves. Book 10 summarizes everything and gives a chronology of Jewish history and an exposition of true doctrine. I'm just running you through it, but I could have brought my copy of Hippolytus and read out, but I just thought it wouldn't. Now, it's clear that Hippolytus had wide research facilities available in Rome because he dealt with the detailed history of Greek philosophy, Chaldean thought, Egyptian thought, even Celtic Druidism, which was interesting to me, having Celtic ancestors, of course, from pagans way back. He knows about the Celtic Druids in the far north. He knows about Brahmanism, Hindu Brahmanism. And other issues in Gnostic thought. He does use some sources that were not found in Irenaeus. Some have said, well, he gets everything from Irenaeus. He probably got some of it, but he comes up with sources, ancient sources, that must have come from libraries in Rome, which was a rich city, and plenty of research facilities. And Hippolytus knew how to use a library, or its equivalent, the various scrolls and rolls and so forth. Let me say something to you, that Hippolytus is a good counterbalance to the 19th century German history of religion school, Religionsgeschichtliche Schule. Who can tell me what's the basic theory or one of the basic theories, operating theories of the history of religion school? Anybody know? I mean, you may not have had to read any of it when you were at the university, but I did some. What did the German history of religion school say? I mean, the brilliant people, extremely well read. I'm not putting them down. But they had what I think is a false thesis. Anybody know? They said all religions are essentially the same. There's no significant difference. Hippolytus didn't believe that, and he proved it from serious research. That all religions in his time, which was many of the same ones we have, weren't anything but the same. Let me say this. The history of religion school, 19th century thing, still influences liberal Christianity, is saying that relativism is required when you find a multitude of different cultures, a multitude of sources, and a multitude of different kinds of theories and ideas going around in the culture. Now, talk to me a minute. Why do you think, I mean, these are intelligent people that came up with that. And they said, well, we've got all this stuff that we didn't have at one time. So relativism is called for. Why do they think it's called for? Who can tell me? I'm not asking you, do you agree, but why would they say that?
In our modern times?
Yeah.
I guess because the influence of postmodernism and the subjectivity of truth,
mm-hmm.
you're your religion is the only way, so therefore all religions are equally valid.
Yeah, exactly. It's horrifying to many people to be called backward. I think it's dreadful. And so to say, well, you know, this finally, you can't know the final truth except that one. You can know that one. And so you can have your truth, and I can have mine, but what is forbidden is you say yours is the right one. So the fact that we have, let's say in South Carolina, you've got, is it BMW or whatever it is in, yeah. And I mean, I'm glad they're there. It gives a lot of jobs. And Charlotte, I forget how many, my wife used to know, Jean, you might know, how many language immersion schools there are in Charlotte. I mean, there's Japanese, there's German, there's Chinese, there's no doubt French, Spanish. I think there's over 20 total immersion schools in different languages. I mean, I rejoice in it. I think it's good. But you could draw a false conclusion. You could say, well, North Carolina up to the 1950s was very conservative. That's correct. But now, since we have all these different theories, people from all over the world, they don't believe necessarily the Bible or Christianity. They have different ideas. So that proves that they're equally intelligent to us. So we weren't right in what we believed. And many a church in Charlotte has changed its preaching on that basis. Is that right?
Don't we find that too? Sometimes I have in the church, people struggle to condemn Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses because they're good people.
Yeah, sure. I was telling a story when I spoke about why we should have an evening service yesterday at Faculty Forum. Can you remember the story, Corey? The concluding story. Uh-huh. Tell them.
Oh, gosh. Okay. I'm trying to remember why she hit him.
Well, this man, who happened to be married to one of my grandmother's cousins, got very angry with me. A Sunday evening service, I preached on Psalm 22 and said there's absolutely no way to God but through Jesus Christ and saving faith in Him. And this man was a big Mason. I mean, later he got totally converted, but at that time the Masonic Lodge was the biggest thing in his life, which teaches that, I don't know, I don't make fun of it, but if you do good deeds, you probably would get in. And he was absolutely infuriated coming out of the church and was raking me over the coals. Then tell him what happened, Corey. Something nice happened.
His wife hit him with
her
umbrella.
His wife, they were both late 70s. It was raining. She had an umbrella rolled up. They were on top of the church steps. And say she was my grandmother's cousin. She was defensive of me. And she took that rolled up umbrella and whammed him on the behind. I'm glad he didn't knock him down all those steps. And then he came back on Wednesday night to prayer meeting. You certainly are a good preacher. So apparently she'd given it back to him. Well, I mean, in Freemasonry, I'm not saying all the Masons are like that. You've got Christians that are Masons. I know all that. But there are many ideas that if you're an intelligent person, you can't believe there's only one way. And one of the reasons is simply that the world is, there are people coming and going everywhere, which is true. But Hippolytus doesn't accept that. He knows Rome is full of every kind of thing from every part of the world, and he studied it rather carefully. And he shows that some of the underlying similarities between the different religious approaches are merely superficial, that they're profoundly different and won't get you to God. I'm just going to mention some things to look for in the in his writing. It's in the Ante-Nicene Church Fathers Erdmann's series. He is very interesting how he exposes the secrecy with which the cultists, people that didn't accept the openness of the Christian church, or the cultists, hid their doctrine from the wider public. He said, look, come to church, we'll tell you what we believe. In the Ante-Nicene series of Erdmann's, you find that on particularly page 10 and 93. Then I want you to notice his interaction with non-Hellenistic thought. In other words, non-Greco-Roman from rather different sections of the globe for his time. He talks about, as I told you, the Northwest Celtic region, Scotland, Ireland, and where my people were from. They knew about it. You know, Druidism and some of their ideas. And as far away as India, Hinduism. They knew about it. Brahmanism, he knew about it, and the class system. In Book 1, Chapter 9, it's page 16 in it, Hippolytus traces down the final principle of humanist thought. Now get this, what's the final principle of humanist thought? Corey, this is not a fair question. Don't necessarily expect an answer, but what would be the final principle of postmodernism, which you accurately brought up a while ago? If you take it down to the roots, what would it be?
I'd say the undermining of anything objective.
Yeah, that's certainly accurate. He traces it down to the humanist materialism of Greek philosophy, this only the material. Now, Richard Dawkins is there. I've been rereading some of Dawkins' material to try to finally get through the revision of this creation and change. And materialism transfers the attributes of God to material. By material, I may mean forces of nature, electromagnetism, gravity, nuclear structure, things like that. And that's the final. That something has to be material to be real. Anything else is non-existent. Now, here's a point that Hippolytus brings out. Particularly look in the reference I've given you on page 150 and 151. And here he precedes St. Thomas Aquinas, his fivefold proofs, via quinque, by about, let's see, Thomas, let's say, was writing it in, I don't know what, 1260. So he is ahead of him by 1100 years. And he says something the same. Here's what he says. When you say, well, everything's material, it's always changing, you can't really know. Hippolytus says, you must get outside creation, at least conceptually, epistemologically. You must get outside creation in order to understand creation. You stay in it, you don't understand. Now that, a lot could be said about Thomas Aquinas's fivefold proof, and I deal with it in medieval theology as best I can. But you take the five proofs together, you know, motion, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's that. You cannot understand creation from within creation. You got to have a point from outside which we know is revelation. It's from God. And finally, to get outside this material shifting nexus, you have to go to the Creator God. And now he knew well. Romans chapter 1. And as I say, I don't take the time how he makes fun of, and I'm very sympathetic with him, of astrology and particularly horoscopes. And shows how phony so many of the tricks are by the magicians, which many people believe, like people believe in witch doctors today. I would say this, and now let me be careful. Don't let me misquoted, but I would say in some areas witch doctors probably do have a certain power to help people or to harm people. It's not necessarily all trickery, but there's a good bit in it. Now let's put, that was, I may not have told you that was number one. I don't know if I did or I didn't. Number one, his anti-heretical work. Hippolytus, number one, his anti-heretical work. Now put number two. His exegetical work. Hippolytus is the first of the church commentators on Scripture who wrote Bible commentaries in the same sort of way that we write them. Everybody had commented on Scripture. That's nothing new. But he's the first one that came up with the concept of a Bible commentary in the way somewhat like what we've done for the last, 1,800 years. He composed many commentaries, and we go to that chair I told you about, funereal chair. Many of the books of Old and New Testament he commented on. Most are lost. The best preserved are those on Daniel, which I have a French translation of the one on Daniel, but I'm sorry to tell you, it's packed. My stuff's being packed up to move to Moore County in the May. But he does have an interesting little commentary on the book of Daniel and one on the Song of Solomon. I've never worked through Daniel, I've read carefully. The one on the Song of Solomon, I've never worked through very carefully. I've glanced at it. Also, there are good sections of his commentaries on Genesis 49. Anybody remember what Genesis 49 is? Anybody know? Blessings of Jacob on his sons. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And in the blessings of Jacob on his son, he had the objective power to convey blessing because he was a patriarch. He was a prophet. And there's a lot of predictions about the future, about Judah and others, what would happen in those blessings of Jacob on his sons. You might be surprised at how accurate some of it is, at least Hippolytus is trying to do. Deuteronomy 33, the blessings of Moses. And then one thing was found in Armenia. Who can tell me where is Armenia? What was Armenia?
Turkey, that general area
there. Yeah, towards Mount Ararat. And the Turks killed out huge numbers of them in the pogroms of the Armenians who were Christians around the time of World War I. Yeah, exactly. Turkish government still doesn't admit it happened, and they killed way over 1 million. Awful. But in Armenia, it was the first country to become Christian. I mean, for the government to say we're becoming Christian. I can't remember what year it was, but in the 2nd century. And there are a lot of monasteries. Some survived the pogroms of the Muslim Turks. And a number of theological works have been discovered in the remnants of those monasteries. And indeed, I think some of the monasteries may have been turned into mosques, but some of the libraries were kept. And some of the works of Hippolytus survived that way. Such as extracts from the Psalms in Armenian language, on David and Goliath and other matters in the Psalms. Now, a good bit that Hippolytus wrote survived because the famous Christian writer Origen often quoted him. I mean, Hippolytus was an original thinker in exegesis, a creative thinker. He certainly didn't get it all right. He's sometimes wildly allegorical, and other times pretty careful. But much that he wrote that has been lost, some have kept in Armenia, and a fair amount survived in what we still have of the Alexandrian scholar Origen, and he got a lot of his inspiration from this man, Hippolytus. Now, let me say a little bit about his... I've read not everything he wrote, but a fair amount of it. Let me see if I can fairly characterize the theological writing, particularly the exegetical writing of Hippolytus. His hermeneutical principle was rather like the Alexandrian school. Is anybody here, I mean, it's probably an unfair question, but could contrast Alexandrian school with Antiochene school?
The Alexandrian school, I think, was really allegorical.
Mm-hmm.
Antiochene,
yeah.
Exegetical.
Yeah, that's right, very good. And so Hippolytus generally went in the direction that the later men, scholars in Alexandria would go, which was allegory. He didn't deny necessarily that such and such had happened, David and Goliath. He certainly believed it had happened, but he gets all kind of things out of it that are really not in the text, reading back into it. Interestingly, scholars have long pointed out that when you use strong allegorism in interpreting the Old Testament, you generally tend to go in an anti-Semitic direction. And Hippolytus did that. He, like Justin Martyr, you know, Justin Martyr, we looked at his dialogue with the Jew Trypho. Hippolytus wrote extensively against the Jews. And he, it seems to me, he was somewhat uneasy with the fact that Old and New Testament are one book, and that we are Judaism Reformed, or they're the church in the Old Testament, we're the church in the New Testament. He may have accepted that, but he's not particularly happy with it. And that affected, I think, his ability to understand even the New Testament. Let me just say a word about his commentary on Daniel. Written about the year 204 Anno Domini. It is the earliest known exegetical treatise of the Christian church that we have. Next time you're at a party and the conversation gets slow, ask them what's the earliest known exegetical treatise that the Christian church has at the drinks table or something. Well, this thing on Daniel, which I have in the French translation, is divided into four books. No great significance is the way he divided it. Hippolytus uses the Greek version of Theodosian as his main text, including the non-canonical sections. You like the story of Susanna and that kind of thing. The first book deals with Susanna. Hippolytus sees in Susanna a prefiguration of the church, the bride of Christ, persecuted by two peoples, the Jews and the pagans. Well, what he doesn't admit and tell you, Susanna was a Jewess. So he somewhat misinterprets it. The second book is of more interest to us. It explains to some degree and not very far afield, actually. It explains the four kingdoms mentioned in Daniel 12 and Daniel 7, which Hippolytus rightly, and commentators have followed him over the many centuries, he explains those four kingdoms as the Babylonian, the Persian, the Greek, the Hellenistic, and the Roman Empire. Babylonian, Persian, or Medo-Persian, Greek, and Roman Empire. At the time he was writing, we know from other sources that there was a tremendous amount of interest in the end of time. Do you know another period in, say, medieval history when there was a great interest in the end of time? Year 1000. That's why some of the cathedrals were built. Tremendous interest, a lot of preaching, enthusiastic preaching on the end of time in and around the year 1000. And so there was in the lifetime of Hippolytus, there evidently a lot of predictions by the Montanists of a speedy end of time. Who are the Montanists? Remember Tertullian? Who can tell me? The group he joined. Well, that, and they believed in amazing outpourings of the Holy Spirit and new revelations. And anyway, they were teaching that God had told them that everything would be over in just a few years. And this is in the 3rd century. And so, you know, in Syria, a bishop had led the people to the desert to wait for Christ. That happened in America with the Millerites in 1844, I'm told. Anyway, the people never learn. Hippolytus was trying, when he wrote this thing on Daniel, he had several purposes. One of his purposes was to show that it will be at least another 300 years before Christ comes back. He didn't say Christ was definitely coming back in 300 years. He's too smart for that. He's only saying it's not next week, and it may be several centuries. So don't get all that excited over it. Well, to my regret, I believe I shall need to break it off. But we got time. If you got some questions, please feel free to raise any questions you may have, because I mean, we're not pushed. I just done probably the best I can for. Yeah, Corey.
I was just wondering, do you have any biblical justification for why he said it wouldn't be for another 300 years?
He thinks there's certain things that have got to be fulfilled, hadn't been fulfilled yet. You know, getting the message out to the rest of the Gentiles and things like that. I mean, it's not much that he says is not that far off from what we'd say today. To that point, yeah. Well, God bless you.